So we're talking about the Z2 quantum lattice gauge theory. The reason why we're doing this is because, first of all, gauge theories are very important in physics, as you know. But there is another reason, because this is part of our story in which we are trying to find another kind of order that goes beyond symmetry breaking. So that's our goal. And OK, so where are we? So we have a parent Hilbert space called the total Hilbert space that is made of a number n equal L times L spins one half, so that H total, sorry, this is the number of sides on a lattice. And if you have a square lattice with periodic boundary conditions, then the total, and you place the spins on the edges of the lattice, then there are two L square edges. And so this means that the Hilbert, total Hilbert space is this one. OK. We have defined the gauge transformations, local gauge transformations at the site n, as the so-called star operators, which means we apply sigma x on each bond of the lattice. We call these operators an, and we use this notation. OK? And the gauge Hilbert space is given by those states in H dot that are invariant under the gauge transformations. So let me just write what I said. Psi in H dot such that an psi equal psi for every n. And we also saw that we can write this as a projection operator on H dot, where this projection operator is the product of every n of the local projection, that is this operator, over H dot. OK. Because of this, yesterday we computed, were able to compute the dimension of this Hilbert space, and we saw that this is equal to 2 to L squared plus 1. The other thing that we were able to do was to define gauge invariant quantities. And we discovered that there are two types of gauge invariant quantities. There are trivial ones that are any operator that contains just a sigma axis. Of course, they commute with your gauge transformation. But the non-trivial ones are objects like this. Let me draw a loop on the lattice. OK. And imagine we apply sigma z along the loop. OK, so let me define the string operator associated to the curve gamma z as the product on the spins that belong to gamma z of sigma z. And yesterday we saw that if gamma is a closed loop, sorry, it's a closed string, it's a loop, then always commutes with all gauge transformations. So these are the gauge invariant quantities. Yesterday, in a dual way, we also, let me make this lattice a bit bigger, we also defined these other types of operators. Let me do it like this. You see, these are curves that run on the dual lattice. So they join the centers of the plaquettes. If you drew the dual lattice, they would run on the links of the dual lattice. Right? And we, in a dual way, we define this gamma, W gamma x, as the product on the j on gamma x of sigma xj. Okay, so this is gamma x, and this one is gamma z. Okay, so these are the gauge invariant quantities. So notice that if I consider just this operator, that is based at the plaquette P, I call it BP. So it's the product of the spins that live around the plaquette of sigma z, right? This is nothing else but a very small loop of the z type. It's the smallest possible loop. And therefore, it commutes with An as well. It's a gauge invariant quantity, right? Okay. So our goal is now to find the basis for our gauge invariant Hilbert space. Okay? And we see that this gauge invariant Hilbert space has this dimension that is 2 to the power L squared plus 1. So it would be very convenient to write this Hilbert space as a tensor product of spins, right? It would be very nice to do that. Of course, mathematically, you can do that if you have any Hilbert space that has this dimension, it does exist a tensor product structure. Actually, there are infinite tensor product structures of this type. Is it clear what I mean by this? So remember that for us, a spin 1 half is just a two-level system. So when you have a Hilbert space that has a dimension that is non-prime, you can always write it as the tensor product of two Hilbert spaces such that the product of their dimensions is the dimension. You have Hilbert space as dimension 6. There will be two Hilbert spaces, one of dimension 2 and one of dimension 3, such that their tensor product is your Hilbert space. And in fact, there are infinite in equivalent tensor product structures that give you the same space.
Sorry. Can you always do that? So suppose we have a four-level system. can they be decomposed into two?
Yeah, I said, as soon as your Hilbert space has a non-prime dimension. If it's, the dimension is prime, there is nothing between heaven and earth, you know, that gives you, it's not prime, right? But this one is not only just not prime, you know, it can be composed in the product of L squared plus one two-dimensional Hilbert spaces. So there are L squared plus one spins. They're not the original spins. So spin, for us, a spin one-off is a, just a two-level system. It's not some specific physical degree of freedom. Then, of course, it can be physical because to every Hilbert space corresponds, there are operators that act on that Hilbert space, and if you can measure them, you measure them, right? But every two-level system for us is a spin one-off. Okay. So we need a basis for this. And, you know, being the tensor product of spins one-off, we just need to find a basis for every C2. So something that has two eigenvalues, right? For instance, plus one and minus one. This labels the states of your C2. And I'm thinking, oh, maybe these BPs are good quantum numbers. So remember, in order to do that, then these numbers that you use to label the basis of a tensor product, they must be the eigenvalues of operators that commute with each other. You know, the so-called complete set of observables that labels your states. Well, the BPs do commute with each other, and they are gauge invariant quantities, so these are good quantum numbers for your gauge invariant Hilbert space. So let's do that, okay? So let's see how many basis elements we have, we can label. So this, of course, has two eigenvalues that are plus one and minus one. Like every operator that squares to the identity, it has two eigenvalues that are plus one and minus one. So I would like to label my states in this way, BP1, BP, how many do I have? How many BPs are out there? Please raise your voice. Yes and no. There are L square BPs, right? There is a plaquette for every site. So in principle, there are L square. However, you are right that we can count only L square minus one of them. Because what you probably have already computed in your mind is to notice that also for these operators, we have a global constraint that this is the identity, the product of all of them. It's exactly for the same reason that this happened for the AN. In fact, for the plaquette operators, it's even easier to see that if I multiply 2 if I multiply many, here I get the square, here I get the square, I get the square, here I get the square, and so on and so forth. Actually, so it's very easy to see it with the Z2, but this is very general. In fact, since all of you have studied physics too, you already know this. This is Stokes' theorem. Right? Okay, so you see, this looks like the circuitation of a field, the product of a field around the loop. Only this field is not U1, like in electromagnetism, it's a simpler field. It, you know, U1 means it has a continuum of values. This one doesn't have a continuum, has only two values. But then, you know, the, as Plato told us, you know, the big leap in imagination is between one and two. After you have two, then everything goes, you know, then you build everything else. You know, instead of being a two-level system, becomes an n-level system, then you make this n very dense, and you know the rest of the story. So I'm saying this to show you how underlying there are some notions that have to do with other gauge fields. I mentioned in the past that from a spin system, it could emerge a theory of photons, for instance. Okay, so in part two, we will do more general gauge theories, and maybe we'll see that. Okay, we will actually do the theory of photons. Okay. So this is a good basis, right, for something. So the span of these states is definitely a basis in at least some subspace of H gauge. Do you agree? The point is this a complete set of observables? Is this a basis for the full H gauge? And at this point, you need to tell me. You should be able to tell whether this is the case and why. So each of these objects can have two eigenvalues, right? 0 and 1, sorry, plus 1 and minus 1. So each of these values can be plus or minus 1. So for instance, any configurations of these B operators, let me call them plaquette operators, is a basis states, right? Like all ones, or 1 minus 1 plus 1, 1, 1 minus 1, you know, like Ising configurations. After all, they're spins. So how many such configurations do I have? Yes. 2 to the L squared minus 1. So we can label L squared minus 1 spins, right? I mean, it's very explicit here. But how many spins do we have in our gauge invariant Hilbert space? L squared plus 1 spins, right? So there are two spins missing. We need to find them. Otherwise, we are just in a subspace. In fact, you know, you could call this as the direct product with the sum j that goes from 1 to, the direct sum of j equal from 1 to 4 of some gauge invariant sectors, right? Each of them spanned by these quantum numbers. But there must be two other degrees of freedom that tells you in which sector you are, right? Because if you have two other spins, then there are four possible values of this spin, which, you know, labels these four subspaces. Do you agree? Please ask me some questions if you're perplexed. So I'm here for this. Okay, yeah, you first.
Yeah, I didn't get how it sums to four.
So h gauge has a dimension 2 to the L squared plus 1. Okay? And 2 to the L squared plus 1 means that, so what is it equal to is 2 to the L squared minus 1 times 4. Right? Okay. And so there are 4 sectors, each of them with this dimension. And I called this sector is this one. This is what I call HJ. Sorry, calligraphic HJ gauge. There must be 4 of them. What was your question?
No, same.
Same question?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. So there are 2 missing degrees of freedom. And how do we find them? Because, so if we take, so what are the gauge invariant quantities? So we have operators that are made of sigma x's. Right? But they must commute with the previous ones, otherwise they're not good quantum numbers. And this basically rules out what we can do with sigma x. Because we have 2 possibilities. Either it is something that does not commute with sigma x's, with the BPs, or it commutes with the BPs, but then you can show, you can do it as an exercise that is made of products of A operators. What I'm saying is 99% correct. So it's not exactly like I said, but it's good enough for now. So we need to look at something made of sigma z. Okay. Problem is that, okay, if it is a loop, then it's made by the products of these squares, right? It's Stokes' theorem, and therefore is already counted in here, right? Because we already have labeled the value of all these of all these squares. Do you understand why this would not be an independent quantum number from what we already have? Okay. Well, the other possibility is that instead of having a loop, you have an open string made of sigma z. And now consider the star operator that lives at the end point of this string. And you see that here, it will not commute. So this will not be a gauge invariant operation. So here we are in a quandary, right? Because on the one hand, there must be 2 spins around that are gauge invariant. But we don't seem to find them. So they're hidden somewhere. Do you have an idea? Yeah.
The 2 cycles of the torus.
Perfect. Wonderful. So, did you already know that, or you just figured out now?
No, I knew it.
Huh?
I knew it.
Okay. Still great. Okay. So your colleague said, look at this operator, and then this connects back to this. So this is still a loop, right? So it is a gauge invariant quantity. However, it's not contractible, right? It's a topologically not trivial loop. And therefore, it cannot be made of the product of contractible loops of squares. You see that every time you have something that is made of squares, then it is contractible. it lives on the surface of the torus in a contractible way, not around the holes. Can you see that? And of course, there are two such things, at least, right? There is one in this direction and one in the other direction. Let me call them W1z and W2z. And they also have two eigenvalues because they're products of sigma z. So they do square to the identity. So these are the two missing spins. So the full basis for H gauge is, so I can label every basis element by BP1 up to BP L square minus 1, W1z, W2z. And the four values that I get from this configuration, right? 1, 1, minus 1, 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, labels these four sectors. They are the labels for those four sectors. Okay. So I can also write this H gauge as the tensor product of these. So K goes from 1 to L square minus 1 of these HBK spins. And then I have the tensor product of this HW1 and the tensor product of this HW2. Do we agree? I'm just writing what I wrote here, right? This is a tensor product of basis states. Okay, so some remarks are in order now. First of all, these are two. But what about other non-contractible loops, right? So it seems that we can label even more states. There are some additional degrees of freedom. But you know, algebra tells us this is not possible because this is the dimension of the H gauge. So there can't possibly be other basis elements, right? Every other vector should be a linear combination of the. So, but why? Why other loops that are non-contractible are not new degrees of freedom?
Sorry, what are the other ones on the picture?
You know, I can take another non-contractible loop.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Right? It's another W.
Yeah. It's just Gauss law.
Huh?
It's just by Gauss law that you can translate this.
You can generate it from B1.
Sorry, I didn't understand what you said.
Should just be able to translate them over by Gauss law to say that they're equivalent.
It is translated, yeah. And therefore?
They're the same operator.
Why it's the same operator? In fact, it's not the same operator.
You generate them by B's, right?
HB.
Yes. The translation is generated by B, by the B piece.
Okay.
So this means that it's independent on the other W alone, but it's not independent on the W's and the B piece. Basically, what a BP does, so this is some string, never mind whether it's contractible or it's a loop or not. I don't know what happens here. Okay? In general, if I operate with the Plaquette operator here, you see, here I get the identity, and I deform it. And by further deformations, you see, then I can do it everywhere. I can translate the whole thing. I can translate, I can bend it, I can do all I want. The only thing that I cannot do is to transform it from non-contractible to contractible. Okay. So that's why there are no other degrees of freedom. That's it. They are, these two loops are not the same operator, but they are equivalent mod this type of transformations. So they're not new degrees of freedom once we have specified all the values of the plaquettes. Yeah?
When you wrote this direct sum over four factors, you said you have two extra degrees of freedom to tell you which factor you're in? Something like this?
Hmm?
Did you say that you have the two extra degrees of freedom to tell you which factor you're in?
These 2 degrees of freedom here are the eigenvalues of these operators, right? They can be plus one and minus one.
Yes.
So that algebraically, they are just like the BPs. So now there are L squared plus one, right?
Yeah, yeah.
L squared minus one, plus one, plus one, it's L squared plus one. I labeled all the states with operators that are all independent, all commute, and they're gauge invariant. It's a complete set of observables. Okay. Now, so this is the Hilbert space of the quantum lattice gauge theory. We can't help noticing that there is something a bit unsettling, especially from the point of view of things that we have learned at the beginning, that we are associating degrees of freedom to, you know, bonds of the lattice or sides of the lattice or plaquettes. That's all fine. Those are, imagine this thing is immersed in real space. Okay? It's a lattice that is embedded in real space. All these degrees of freedom are very fine, but these two Hilbert spaces, are very non-local, right? They live on an extended space. And we find this a bit disturbing. In fact, gauge theories are a bit strange. Okay, so it is not clear what physical mechanism, you know, so nature could do that. It does it with electromagnetism, a fundamental symmetry. But imagine, you know, I have a spin system and I want to make a gauge theory. How do I do this? It's not a fundamental symmetry unless I just declare it mathematically. But we have this physical principle that everything should be local. The Hilbert space of a gauge theory is non-local. Okay, so let's keep that in mind because we will want to address this point and make everything local later. Okay, so this is just the Hilbert space. You see, we all this work to find just the Hilbert space. Now we would like to have a Hamiltonian, so that we say, oh, this is the theory. So the theory is a Hilbert space and the Hamiltonian. One of you asked me, what is a theory in quantum physics? And the answer is a Hilbert space and a Hamiltonian. Okay, so we want H for H gauge. So please tell me how we should look for it. So what is the minimal requirement? Remember what we learned from this very simple case of the particle on a circle. What is the minimal requirement for such an Hamiltonian?
Gauge invariant.
Must be gauge invariant. No? So you guys always are actually very familiar with these things because you have done gauge theories, you met them, you know the Hamiltonian must be gauge invariant because otherwise it's not physical. And I, at least when I was a student, you know, I swallowed all this because it sounded right, but it's not like I really knew why. Now you know why. It's because a non-gauge invariant Hamiltonian would take you out of your Hilbert space. Right? If this does not commute with the gauge transformations we saw it, then this would not belong to the gauge invariant Hilbert space. So in order for this to be an operator on here, this is a requirement. It's a requirement both mathematically and physically. If the two states that are related by gauge transformation are identified, are the same state, A psi is psi in H gauge, then the energy of these two states must be the same, because they're not two states, they're the same state. So you'd see this is usually we say, oh, you know, this is a gauge symmetry because we have a symmetry for the Hamiltonian. But actually, it's not a symmetry. That's an abuse of language that is actually very misleading. We do not have two states that have the same energy. This is just a gauge. In fact, it's called a gauge structure. It's acknowledging that in identifying states, then the Hamiltonian must know that those states are the same. So that it correct, you know, gives the energy to that state in an unambiguous way. And mathematically, this means it has to commute. Okay. Very good. So when we write a gauge invariant Hamiltonian, so a Hamiltonian for the Z2 theory, we need to have something. No, it must be gauge invariant, so it must commute with the AN. Plus, we have our usual rules. It must be the sum of local operators. Okay. So we know that every Wilson loop of Z is gauge invariant, and everything that is made of sigma axis is gauge invariant. So, you know, we can just write our Hamiltonian in this way, the sum of some Wilson loops and the sum of x things. But we also want to make it as local as possible. So the most local x operator is x, sigma x. Right? So I will just have here this sum. Let me put the coupling constant here. And the most local Wilson loop is the plaquette. So this is the sum over the plaquette operators. There you go. This is the Hamiltonian of the Z2 lattice quantum lattice gauge theory. Questions?
But this is not the most general one, right?
No, it's the most local one.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
And we declare it, now we define, you know, a theory is defined by Hilbert space and the Hamiltonian, and I call this the Hamiltonian, you know, this is the Z2 lattice quantum gauge theory, and the motivation is the most local possible. Mm. Yep.
So what about the problem that we had before, that we had bigger loops, we had non-contractible loops, are we going to...
Yeah, so this problem, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, so we still have that problem. So we need to go one step forward to make everything very local also in every possible way. At the very least, this is a local Hamiltonian. You know, our Hilbert space is not local, and that's disturbing. We will need to address that, but I hope we can do that in the second lecture of today. Okay, now let's, you know, live with this fact that the Hilbert space is not local, and let's try to understand what are the properties of this theory. Okay? So, as usual, we will try to look the first of all the theory in different limits because it's easier. Was there a question around? No. Okay. So first of all, is this this Hamiltonian? You feel this is easy to diagonalize, or it is hard? Do these operators commute? Do these operators and these operators commute? No. Okay. So it's a bit like the quantumizing model, right? Because these operators anti-commute. However, it's harder than that because this is now on a 2D lattice, not on the 1D lattice. On the 2D lattice, you know, you can do the Jordan-Wigner transformation. So nobody knows how to diagonalize exactly the icing, quantum icing theory on a square lattice. You can only do it numerically. And so we have something similar here, okay? So let's look at how this theory works in different limits, and then let's try to argue about the physical properties of this theory, you know, using other things other than just diagonalizing. Okay, so let's first look at the limit g equals zero. Okay, so this is very easy because for g equals zero, j equals zero. So the Hamiltonian is this one. And we know everything about this Hamiltonian. We know what this is. This is a paramagnet. The ground state is unique, and it is this one. There is a gap above the ground state, and correlation functions at the very least decay exponentially. Okay, and in fact, I want to show you that correlation functions are actually in this limit exactly zero. And the way you do that is imagine that you want to compute this object. Okay, in the ground state. In fact, let me first compute a very trivial correlation function. The one-point correlation function means demagnetization. Okay. Well, it is obvious that if this is plus, then this brings me in minus, so we have that this expectation value is equal to its opposite, so it must be zero. Okay. What about this one? This is still, you get two orthogonal states, right? Because you get, when this operates on this, what you get is psi zero, which is the tensor product k and k prime, over pluses, right? And then you have a state that is all pluses, and there are two minuses at the position I and j, and these two are orthogonal states. Okay. Okay, but we are just rediscovering things that we already knew. In the paramagnet correlation, you know, in the polarized state, these functions are all zero. Okay. So this is really trivial. It's called, as we know, disordered phase. Why it's called disordered phase? Because every operator that breaks the symmetry has expectation value zero. What is the operator that breaks the symmetry here? What is the symmetry? A. The operator that breaks the symmetry is sigma z. It's the one I showed is zero. So there is no spontaneous symmetry breaking. No residual magnetization. Good. But now see the limit g equals zero. Okay, now this is very interesting. So our Hamiltonian is just the sum of the plaquettes. And now let's try to find out what is the spectrum of this Hamiltonian. Because, you know, minus j. You know, these are all operators that do commute. And in fact, this is very easy to find because the basis states are eigenstates of this Hamiltonian. Do you see that? That all the basis states are eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. One way of seeing this is these are all commuting operators that have two eigenvalues, plus one and minus one. So this is like a very simple sum on Ising spins. And therefore, you know, you have done enough problems. You know that the spin configurations label the energy. So what is the ground state for this one? You have to tell me now.
All the eigenenergies plus one.
All the eigenvalues plus one? All the eigenvalues of what?
BP.
OK, so I agree, every time BP has eigenvalue plus one, you get an energy minus j. Every time you have a BP equal minus one, you get an energy plus j, so you go up of 2j. So to minimize the energy, I can just put all of them in the ground state independently because they commute. So the ground state is when all these have a plus one. So we already know that the ground state energy is equal to minus nj. But the state is BP1 equal plus one, right? Comma BP, this one is L square minus one. Yes, equal plus one. We're not done yet. But we have more states. So you see, this must be this is a ground state that lives in H gauge. So we need to decide what is the value of these guys. What do you think?
Arbitrary.
Arbitrary. Why? Why arbitrary?
Gauge invariant.
Not because they're gauge invariant.
There's no energy.
If they were not gauge invariant, they would simply not label the states.
Because it doesn't factor in the Hamiltonian, so the energy is same.
No, it's not because they don't factor in the Hamiltonian, it's because they commute with the Hamilton. So this means that once we have decided this a value of the energy, you know, so let's just do that, right? So imagine that I have a given configuration that is all the BP is equal 1, and then W1 is equal plus 1, and W2 equal plus 1. Okay? And now I apply my some operator that changes, I don't know how to call it yet, is, let me call it W tilde, the operator that changes one of these things. Okay, so now I want to look at the new energy in this state when you have minus one. Well, I need to look at the expectation value of this thing with this Hamiltonian, and they do not play any role. But, yeah, so W1z, one second, and W2z are whatever. Yeah, so what was that?
Yeah, but BP also commute with H, right? Single BP, like B1. So you cannot say that one operator commute with Hamiltonian, then it's not important.
No, that's true, but
I think
what I mean is that once you have fixed these values,
uh-huh.
Okay, then because this commutes with Hamiltonian, then these values cannot change, and so it is the expectation value is the same. This is what I said.
They are nearly equivalent to say that this term are absent in the Hamiltonian.
No. You see, no, it's not the same. So imagine that I'm taking a specific plaquette.
Uh-huh.
And I freeze the eigenvalue of all the other plaquettes. Okay? Now the energy is not determined. I have to tell you what is the value of this plaquette.
Yeah, what I'm thinking that there are many operators that both absent in the Hamiltonian and commute with Hamiltonian, like the B1, B2, the product of B1, B2. So why we don't consider
the product of B1, B2 is determined once you have fixed B1, B2.
Uh-huh.
But the value of W is not fixed once you determine the value of all the Bs.
Okay.
This is what I mean.
Okay.
Okay. But if W1 and W2 were not commuting with the Hamiltonian, then you could not argue that they have the same energy. Because the fact that we've frozen those degrees of freedom, you know, if some other thing that does not commute, you know, okay, changes value. Okay. So what does the spectrum look like? We have the ground state that has energy minus nj, and how many states we have in the ground state?
Four.
Four, right? For the four possible values of this pair of degrees of freedom. So this means W1z is equal plus 1, W2z equal plus 1, minus 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1, minus 1. They're degenerate. Yep.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about the ground state energy. So we're getting this from looking at like the BPs being all plus one.
Yeah.
So are there n minus one of them?
No, no. There are, how many plaquettes are there?
Okay, but then, yeah, so there's n, but if we're only labeling.
I understand this means that there are only n minus one independent of them.
Okay.
That's fine, but there are n of them. Each of them gives you some energy.
Okay, right.
But your remark is a very important thing because it's telling us something. Imagine, so you will see the meaning of your remark right now. Okay, so you agree these are the four states and they have energy minus nj. Mm-hmm. Now imagine, what is the first excited state? What is that I can do? So let's do the first excited state of this Hamiltonian. What do we do? We flip?
Flip one BP.
Okay, now let's everyone think about your colleague's remark. Because as he justly said, the BPs are not all independent. What happens if I flip one of the BPs? So let me write it. Let's say that for B tilde, BP tilde is equal minus one, right? This is what we're done. But they're not all independent because we know that the product of all these numbers must be one.
So both flip the even number of BPs.
Yes. We can only flip an even number of BPs. So that's the consequence of that. So those energies are there, but there is a constraint. You cannot have a single plaquette monopole, right? That leaves alone. You have pairs. Okay, so the next, so this means that the first excited state is flipping two plaquettes. So what energy does it have? Ah, you have to tell me.
Plus 4J.
Good. It has 4J energy above E0. Is E0 plus 4J? Okay, so here you have a gap that is 4J. And every successive gap is still 4J, right? Because then you can flip other two plaquettes and you get another energy of 4J. And question, so the ground state is fourfold degenerate. What is the degeneracy of the first excited state?
Choose two, because we're just choosing two
second like
operators.
Is n choose two
times four,
because still we can choose this as we want. Okay, so this is n choose two times four. This is four. Each of them has a four. And if you sum over k and choose k, if you do this sum and then you multiply by 4, you should get 2 to the L squared plus 1. So okay, try to do it as an exercise. Good. So we have this degeneracy. And now we are very, so there is some symmetry breaking here. I mean, this is the way we are used to thinking. However, if there is a symmetry breaking, this means that if I operate with the symmetry operator on one state, I jump onto the other state, remember? If there is symmetry breaking, means that your ground state is not commuting with your symmetry. But they're commuting, obviously, they're invariant. All the states in here, because it's a gauge theory, which is the same. This fact means you can't spontaneously break a local symmetry. You can't. It's called the Elitzur theorem. It exists also in classical physics. And we will prove the theorem and so and see the Z2 lattice gauge theory, the classical one in part two. So the only symmetries that can be spontaneously broken are global symmetries. So as you can see, there is not spontaneous symmetry breaking. This is degeneracy without spontaneous symmetry breaking. Yeah,
2 minutes.
2 minutes, great. In other words, there are no local operators that connect these states. If there were, there would be some spontaneous magnetization. So let me just show you why there cannot be any spontaneous magnetization. So I must take a state in the ground state and compute sigma z, which is the operator that breaks our symmetry. Right? This is how we decide that there is symmetry breaking and spontaneous magnetization. However, psi zero is invariant under An. And I can, for every An. And now I can choose, so this is at some link L. Okay? So let's say it's this link. And now I can choose N that is adjacent. So you see now they anti-commute. So this means this is equal to minus psi zero An sigma z L psi zero. And An on psi zero gives me psi zero because they're invariant. This is an Hermitian operator. So minus psi zero sigma z L psi zero. And so you see this is equal to its opposite. So it must be equal to zero. Or if you want to take it to the other side, you see the two that the expectation value is zero. So this is zero. There you go. No spontaneous symmetry breaking, which is identical to saying there is no operators that connects this local operator that connects these states. Therefore, Hastings' theorem that we studied applies. So we have what we were looking for, a degenerate ground state with a gap, but correlation no long range order. There cannot be long range order. This is a new kind of order. Okay, so in the second lecture, I will show you why this kind of order is topological. Okay, and then we'll try to make this theory more physical because it all looks like a weird game that we can obtain because we violated some rules, right, when we made this non-local Hilbert spaces.